Welcome to the Victorious Souls Podcast with self-love coach Danielle Burnock. Things happen in our lives that make us feel powerless. But Danielle believes that anyone can become a victorious soul by reclaiming what belongs to them, their value, their belovedness, and their God-given superpower. The Victorious Souls Podcast is dedicated to empowering you to rise up, reclaim, and embrace the change from survive to thrive as a victorious soul through the power of love. And now, here's that lady on the internet who loves you, Danielle.
Welcome to the Victorious Souls Podcast with me, your host, Danielle Burnock from DanielleBurnock.com, that lady on the internet who loves you, connecting you to the love that heals so you can go from survive to thrive and learn how to love yourself and have a good, thriving life. And today I have a gentleman with me named Guy Morris. He has been through so much, and I'm accentuating that on purpose, so much trauma, but in spite of that, he has accomplished so many amazing things. He had this 36-year-long leadership career. He has written for Disney. He has written for Sojourn Entertainment. He has been a paddy driver. I don't even know what that is. He's done so many amazing things, and he's here today to share his story with you so you can be encouraged to be a victorious soul. So thank you for being with me today, Guy, and thank you for daring to talk about some things I know that are not very easy to talk about.
Thank you, Danielle. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start with, you've been through so much. What can you share with us about your childhood and growing up?
I grew up in an extremely chaotic, violent, addicted, dysfunctional, on almost every level, childhood. I ran away first when I was four, then again when I was six, and then again for several months when I was 13, and then left home finally when I was 15. And most of that was all to try and escape the environment that I was in. And there are many parts of my childhood that for decades were lost in a fog of amnesia. I was told later on that that was a protective mechanism, because I wasn't able to really fully deal with those issues. And until I was fully able to deal with those issues, they were lost to me. The challenge was, is they still affected me and they still drove me, but it was hard to understand what was driving me because I couldn't remember the base points. I can say that, that I feel blessed that I've been able to overcome all of that. I suffered for decades in silence. It left me with chronic depression, with hyper anxieties, with multiple addictions, with constant relationship issues. And I had to go through 12-step and therapy and church and a number of things to try and overcome that. I can say that the violence in my home was not just towards others, but towards myself, that there was I left home when I was 13 because of a threat of death. And it was either survive on my own or die at home. And that was a traumatic time for me to be 13 years old on my own on the streets of LA. But it taught me that I could survive. That there was a resilience there. I worked alongside migrant workers to eat. I sometimes had to steal clothes and food in order to stay warm and fed. It was not a time that I felt proud of. It was a rough way to begin my adulthood, but it taught me that ultimately, if I persevered, that I could take care of myself. And while that was traumatic, that was a better alternative than being at home. Yeah. And when I finally left home, it was to basically hitchhike all the way to Tucson, Arizona, and join a Christian commune. And so while I was on the street was actually when I came to know Christ. And I was, at the time, I had gotten involved in a fight that I didn't want to be involved in. I had, my shirt was bloody, my dirt clothes were dirty, and somebody came up to minister to me, and for whatever reason, my heart was ready, and I sat there in a gutter, dirty gutter on the street, just crying my eyes out. Yeah. That, I had no idea who Christ was. I had never been to church before. I had no spiritual background whatsoever. I had no spiritual indoctrination whatsoever. It was a pure response of need and faith.
Wow. Oh, this commune that you went to, was that end up being a good thing or a bad thing? Sometimes I hear about
things
they can turn into cults. So I don't know when it was. So
this one wasn't. This one was actually based out of a pretty solid church in Tucson, Arizona. They were a little on the conservative side, but they had, and I didn't stay at the actual commune too long. I only stayed about 3 or 4 months until I could find a job. Because of my childhood and so many times I had been wounded by people that I should have been able to trust, I had trouble trusting anybody.
Oh, yeah.
Including strangers, including Christians and everybody. And so there was always a strong desire in me to basically have my independence and build a relationship on my terms where I always had an out. So I wasn't there that long. It was actually, it was great to be able to sit with other people and read the word. I hadn't been able to read the word before. I was somewhat, because I had lost so much schooling, I was functionally illiterate. Mm-hmm. And so I had trouble actually reading the Bible out loud. And but there were some really great people. I stayed with that church for several years, even though I wasn't living at the house anymore. What was great about the church is that they didn't believe in having an, I think this was a real wisdom on their part, was that they actually had 5 different pastors and they all had different theological and experiential backgrounds. One had grown up as a missionary in Mexico his entire life. And so he had a real heart for homeless people and people who were downtrodden. And really, we had a very vibrant street outreach ministry to people that were disadvantaged that I felt right at home becoming part of almost immediately. There were people who had Lutheran backgrounds, people who had Assembly of God backgrounds, people who had, I think there was one that was had a Baptist background. And they all took turns in preaching and in ministering. And it created, and if one of them ever got out of line, which happened once with the lead pastor, they were able to call him to account to say, hey, you need to step down for a little bit and really get this part of your life right. And they would do so with humility and grace. Mm-hmm. And it taught me so much about how the real church should work. Mm-hmm. That when I went to other churches where I saw pastors who really wanted to be more celebrities, mm-hmm. than servants, I always brought that root with me and could usually discern, you know, where churches were really building up idols as opposed to building servants. And that was a really great experience for me. So it rooted me. It gave me a great rooting in the word. It gave me great examples on how to follow the Lord with obedience and with humility. I'm really, truly grateful for that time, that phase of my life.
Wow. It sounds like a beautiful thing. Wow. Thank you, Lord, for giving him that. I mean, after all that, before that, to have such a beautiful representation of that. Yes, you're fortunate for that. And a lot of people, they never taste that. They go to the other places and get hurt at church and have, you know, things are just out of whack.
Well,
so I
did get hurt with churches after that. Mm. And the good thing for me was that God was gracious enough to me to give me that example so that when I was hurt at other churches, I didn't use that as an excuse to turn away from God entirely, as much as try to learn to be more selective and discerning with where I would want to go fellowship with others.
Yeah.
And all
identify churches, that it's the people, not God.
I was just gonna say all churches have some amazing, wonderful Christians and people within them. Even when churches that might have some false teachings, even churches that might have poor leadership, no matter what the challenges of each individual church are, there are always somebody in that church that's truly committed and devoted and passionate about their faith and willing to share it and willing to sacrifice and who really represents and reflects the spirit of the Lord better. And it's interesting because the early church kind of taught us that as well. And if we look at the seven messages to the seven churches of the end times, which I believe we're part of, we see that reflected, that there's some good, but there's something that needs to be addressed. And we can't just focus just on the good without looking at the things that need to be addressed. And we shouldn't just focus on the things that need to be addressed without acknowledging and recognizing that there's some good.
Amen. That's important to note. I think that's very important to note, because there's no growth without seeing where we need. And there's no encouragement without seeing what something we're doing right. We really need both of them.
Yeah.
Wow. So how did you get into your career? You had this really rough upbringing, but then you ended up in this commune that gave you a certain amount of stability, but still you had all your trust issues. So sure, there were like walls around you to some extent, but then you've got this amazing, you know, leadership thing, and you're writing for Disney and, you know, writing the songs. And how'd you do that?
My life transformed. I was 19 years old. I had already gotten married at the time, because there was a lot of pressure and for young men to get married so that they didn't sin.
Yeah.
My first wife got pregnant right away, because nobody believed in birth control at the time. So there were some things there that I would probably go back and redo, but nonetheless, I was actually working a really tough job. I was working 6 days a week, about 15 hours a day. It was beating me up, and I would want to just go to church on Sunday and then sleep all Sunday afternoon because I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of pressure on me from my wife to basically have more of a life. And I said, well, I can't get more of a life till I get a different kind of job. And I can't get a different kind of job unless I quit this one so I can go actually look for a job, because they didn't have the internet back then. I couldn't just go online at night and apply. You had to go in person to apply. And so we were actually in prayer one day, and this is a series of miracles that happened. And I'm asking the Lord sincerely, can I send my wife back to work just long enough so that I could find another job? I didn't really want to make her be a breadwinner, because that was also frowned upon in that culture. And in prayer, I felt the Lord's. Now, I was functionally illiterate. I had dropped out of school with a GED in the 10th grade. I missed half of the 9th grade. I was suspended or kicked out of multiple schools. I really had poor grade averages. I was told my entire life that I was really dumb, and that if I was the best I was hoped could to do was to join a trade union and learn how to work with my hands. And so I'm in prayer. And I had no money to even swap jobs. So I'm in prayer, and I feel the Lord telling me, he says, I want you to go to college.
What? And how am I supposed to do that with this big job and no money?
Exactly. I'm thinking, I said, and it was a very clear, it was one of the very few times in prayer. Most of the time we go to prayer and we might get an impression from the Lord. We might feel something. We might get an idea. But very few times in my life can I say the Lord's, I felt an audible voice, a clear, distinct voice that didn't come from inside me, because I didn't understand this at all. And I'm like, what? I said, I've got cross signals. There's airwave interference. Something's wrong here. He said, no, Lord, I'm talking about sending my wife back to work so I can get another job. I don't have the money. We're poor. And I go back to prayer. And several minutes later, I felt, I want you to get up right now, go get up, pick up the phone, call the university and ask for an application. You're going to go to college. So I'm like, well, okay. This is exercise in faith, I guess. You know, it's like one of those things, throw the net on the other side of the boat. Okay, I'm going to throw the net. I don't think I'm going to go to college, but something's supposed to happen. Maybe I'm just supposed to realize that whatever job I have, I should be, I don't know what's going on. Okay. And I get up and I tell my wife what I'm doing. And she's like, what? she couldn't believe it either. So anyway, I called, I asked for an application. It came almost like within 2 days. It was very quick. Now, this is the beginning of September. School started at the end of September, or it's beginning of August, rather. School started at the end of August. And I'm thinking, there's absolutely no way I'm going to go to school. I don't have the money. I never took SAT tests. I don't even have my transcripts. I had to get to fill the application out. I had to get my first wife's help because I was so functionally illiterate. I didn't know how to respond to some of the questions. So we get my transcript back, and it turned out that I had gone to 16 different schools between first and 10th grade, and I couldn't remember two-thirds of them. So I'm thinking this is just all an exercise in I didn't even know what. And I didn't tell anybody about this because I was ashamed that it seemed so out of context to who I was. My nickname at that church for a couple of years was Punk, because I was a street kid. I was a street kid with rowdy street clothes and a foul mouth and a little bit of an attitude on chip on my shoulder. And the idea that God would send me to college was just ludicrous. Well, as it turns out, 2 weeks before school was supposed to start, it only took them 2 or 3 weeks or something to respond to me. I was accepted. I was well over a year and a half deficient in the minimum requirements to get into college, but they decided to waive that. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, holy cow. I said, I thought college was for really smart people who worked really hard all through school and got really good grades. I said, they'll take anybody. And I said, well, this is really interesting. I said, but I still don't have any money. And so it was, I can't remember the time. Sorry for dotting my I's. I have tree allergies. And it's that time of year. So anyway, I threw it away. I threw the envelope away. I thought, well, this was an exercise in I don't know what. I still got to go get another job. The very next day, I got a letter from my father-in-law, who was concerned that I wasn't going to be able to provide for his daughter in the way that she deserved, and that he felt that I had some kind of potential, but I never had any opportunities growing up, and he really wanted me to consider, to seriously humble myself enough to consider him helping to pay for my tuition and books if I would still work to basically provide my overhead. He would allow me to go to, he would help me go to college. And my wife had never talked to him. I had never talked to him. We'd never expressed any desire to go to college because I thought it was so out of the realm of possibility for me. But this was confirmation that the Lord was calling me to go to college. And so I did. I accepted the help. It was very tough, to be honest, for the first few years. My illiteracy really was a hindrance, but I felt that I had to work as if my life depended on it and if my obedience to the Lord depended on it, because in my mind it did on both counts. And so I probably got about an average of 3 or 4 hours sleep a night for 5 years. I was working a part-time job to pay our overhead. I was taking 22 to 24 units of credit to try and catch up with everything. Somewhere around the middle of my second year, my sophomore years, I started going from C's and D's to B's and A's. And then by my senior year, it was straight A's. I had something clicked and it just started, the faster it went, the more it went, the faster it started going. And I really started to come into my own. Part of my graduation was I had to build a macroeconomic model. And I really wanted to go to grad school at that point. And so I made a deal with the dean of the college that if my model could outperform other people and everybody else in the school, that I wanted him to at least consider me for a scholarship. because at that point I was out of money. My father-in-law had passed away. The rest of the family was resentful that I was using any of the family money to go to college, and it was basically gone at that point. And so I did. I spent every night from midnight to about 8 a.m. in the morning in the computer center, at the basement of the computer center on a terminal, building my model. And as it turned out, and I worked so hard at it that I actually got sick. I got Valley fever and was in bed for about 3 months. But I finished the model. And when the results came out, I had not only outperformed everybody in the school, I outperformed the Federal Reserve. I outperformed every one of the major banks and every other one of the other major business universities in the nation, including Harvard and Wharton and Northwestern. And so I got my scholarship. I got accepted into Harvard, but I couldn't afford to go to Harvard. So I took the scholarship in Arizona and I got a job. IBM hired me based on that. And that started my career. And for many years, for the first several years of my career, I was the, I like to kind of call myself the smart whiz kid, basically, that they kept in the dark room in the back of the hall, you know, just basically doing, building things and doing things. And I was very still extremely uncomfortable with interacting with people. I had no real confidence in terms of my interpersonal relationships. And that over time, I kept being put in those positions where I had to. After a couple of years, I was reporting directly to VPs and the CXOs as sort of their, you know, their brainy, you know, their propeller head on a stick. And but over time, I kept being thrown into leadership opportunities where I had to build my own team, and often from scratch. I want you to go do this task, Morris, and you don't have anybody. You're going to have to hire somebody and write your own job description and build your own plan. And by the way, this is a career defining move for you. If you fail, that's it. If you make it, you could go, you know, you could write your next ticket. And that defined most of my career. And I went through 36 years between IBM and Occidental Petroleum and Oracle and Burroughs and Microsoft, essentially trying to always go after the new innovative thing, because that was what I felt comfortable with, which is trying to take the needle and move it forward by understanding how technology would work, or understanding how things, the economy was working and things needed to be changed in order to be prepared for that. And so it was a wonderful opportunity for me. It transformed my life entirely. And that's how I entered into that realm.
Okay. Now, like you had a lot of something that trauma survivors have is something called trauma drive. It sounds like you were put in the same kind of position over and over again, where it was pass or fail. You know, you have to either leave home or you can stay home and die. You're either going to go to school or you're not. You're going to go. It seemed like you were put in that position a lot, but
I called it chronic desperation.
God is fail here. How he does that, it's almost entertaining. It's almost funny how he will use something that is a setback to us to our advantage. Like it says, he uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And how he used your trauma drive to succeed in these high-pressure situations, which would have caused so many other people to crumble.
The other smart people in the business would basically steer away from it because failure meant that they would fail and they were afraid to fail. But for me, I had already failed. I had already been on the streets. I felt that I never imagined going to college. I never imagined working for CXOs of major Fortune 100 corporations. And if God put me there and they were asking me to do this, I was just going to try and say yes and put everything I had inside of me into it to make sure I could succeed the best I could. And now that stress triggered my post-traumatic PTSD. And I didn't understand that connection for a long time. It was just chronic for me to basically go after those live or die scenarios. Mm-hmm. And while on one level, it worked extremely well for me in my career, on a personal level, I was suffering.
Oh, yeah.
I would always be hyper anxious going to work. I was chronically depressed at home. I had alcohol issues from the time I was 11 years old all the way through to my mid 30s, drug issues, promiscuity issues. I lost my first marriage. I lost custody of my daughter. I got custody of my son only because he was a problem child. My wife, first wife, didn't want to deal with him, which was a blessing for both of us because we needed each other. But during that time, one of the things I had learned, I picked up in college that really resonated with me were men of the Renaissance. And men of the Renaissance were trained in science and business and architecture and art and religion. And they were the idea was to be an extremely well-rounded individual. And I was doing that in an age where there was a lot of pressure to be a specialist in something. Mm-hmm. And so while I was doing all these things, I would write songs and I would record and I led worship in Venice Beach, California and other places. And I would try and explore, I wrote short stories for my son when he was like 11 and 12. And I was always trying to explore a creative, adventurous side of me. In part because I had read studies about having a balanced brain. I was inspired by the men of the Renaissance. And I was growing up, you never have hope of being able to do fun things. It's always like what you have to do just to survive. And the idea that I had at least enough energy and money left over where I could try and explore something fun was a privilege that I wanted to not let go by.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to just take it for granted. And so I pursued those things as hard as I pursued my career.
Oh, that's wonderful. Had to be healing in some aspect. When did you start your healing journey within all of this hard work and stuff? Somewhere in there, healing became a part of the story too. I know you're still working on that a lot, but you've made a lot of progress.
I think it was after my divorce when I started feeling the same feelings of being a loser and being worthless from my childhood started really bubbling up again. And I was a single parent to my son. And at a certain point in time, I came to the realization that my alcohol and my promiscuity and some of my other issues were hurting my ability to be a good father, were standing in the way of my ability to be the kind, I didn't want to be the kind of parent to him that I had, as an example. And so there was a motivation in me to start dealing with those things. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to therapy, and to be honest, for years, therapy was only moderately helpful on minor levels, in part because I could only afford the new kids coming out of college. And they had schooling, but not really a lot of life experience. None of them could really relate to the kind of childhood I had grown up with, I had experienced, even to the minor extent I was able to talk about it at the time, which I rarely did because I really couldn't remember it. And I always had this idea, well, it's in my past. Obviously, my problems that I'm having today must be based on something I'm doing now. But I went to 12-step until it worked. I went through, journaled and read self-help books on addiction and recovery. I stopped going to church for a while because I was just working so hard. I was exhausted. So I went back to church and started getting involved in a good church again. And it took a while, but it was a big motivation was to be a better parent to my son. And hopefully I was trying to get rid of my depression, trying to get rid of my anxieties. Now, those things never really fully went away. And because the therapist really was having trouble helping me and nobody at church understood, I would tell them that, hey, I'm going through a lot of difficulties and I'm drinking as a result. I would have just gotten judgment. And so there was a tendency, which for me to keep that personal part of my life secret. Now the secrecy made it worse because it added sort of this sense of hidden shame. And so it was a cycle that took me a while to really get through. But ultimately, once I got clean and sober, that really helped a lot. Once I really started getting in touch with my faith again and started writing worship songs again and started kind of trying to writing songs for me was a therapeutic process because it forced me to basically find something meaningful to say in two verses and a chorus. And it was a way for me to kind of process things.
Yeah.
Obviously the other things I was doing, the Patty, it's not driver, but diver. I might have a typo in
maybe I read it wrong,
but it's I went diving I love doing high risk dives into deep wrecks and I would go cageless shark diving, where we would actually feed the sharks.
Me.
my second wife thought I was crazy, and maybe I am. So the judgment's still out. But yeah, it was the healing started back in my early 30s after my divorce, when I started really having to look at myself and say that for all the success I'd had, for all the blessings I had, for going to college and getting multiple degrees and working in great, great jobs, why was I still lying on on drugs and sex and all these other things to basically numb the other feelings and escape the depression and try and mask it with other things? And it took a ruthless, rigorous honesty and self-evaluation to start recognizing that, yes, I had achieved some good things, but it wasn't enough to change those fundamental things about myself that I really didn't like. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want my past to define my future. I didn't want those things to define my future. I didn't want to become like the people I had grown up with were. And so I was motivated, particularly for my son, to do whatever I had to do to find a way to change. And so if one therapist didn't work, I would wait a while, kind of licking my wounds, and then I would go find another one. If I went to 12-step and then I fell back, I would go back. And it was a goal to get beyond it. My second marriage made a huge difference. I was single parent for 10 years. And had pretty much given up any hope at all. My conclusion was, I'm really good at a lot of different things. Picking a woman, is not one of those things. That's where I am totally, a doofus. And I always pick the wrong ones. I'm sure it had to do now, looking back, I'm sure it had to do with my childhood and role models and everything else. And I didn't understand the psychology at the time, but I just was really bad at picking all the wrong women. And so I had given up. I just said, well, I'm destined to be single. That's okay. I'm living a good life. I'm diving. I'm sailing. I have a job. I have my son. I'm playing music. I've got a full life. And so I should just focus on that. And about that time, the Lord brought my second wife along, and while my first marriage was married to she was schizophrenic, she was bipolar, she had really serious mental issues. And it was ironic because her dad actually tried to warn me of these things before we got married. I just thought he was trying to scare me off because I was the poor dumb kid. He turned out to be right. He was being honest with me, but I married anyway. And so my second wife turned out to be an angel, and that brought some healing. But not entirely. I still struggled with hyper anxiety. I still, even with Oracle and Microsoft and the other jobs I had, I would always tend to put myself in high risk situations and high pressure situations. And that fed on those things that, even though I really had gotten through my alcoholism and drug addictions, heavy drug addictions, I would had sleepless nights. I had chronic sleep issues where I could maybe get 2 or 3 hours sleep a night, and I was constantly exhausted and so it I ultimately wound up cracking. I burned out and I cracked and lost a job in my mid-50s, and it just triggered so many things that I just kind of went off the deep end. Mm-hmm. And it, for a guy who had a reputation for being the calm, stable, you know, logical, rational person, I had lost control. Mm-hmm. And that was about the time when I finally was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And realized that all of the issues I had dealt with in silence for decades all related back to that one primary issue.
Right. And I'd like to pause here for a minute, because you were diagnosed with complex PTSD, right?
Complex, and I didn't understand the difference.
I know the difference. That's why I'm pausing here. Because complex is because of the variety, there's so many different things that you've been through. Whereas PTSD, even though it's awful and I'm not minimizing it, it is from a single event. You didn't have a single, you had multiple, and that's what complicates it, which makes it complex. So I wanted to pause here for our listeners who might not know the difference between that, because it was complex.
It was the consistency, repeatability, almost daily existence of trauma in my childhood.
Yeah.
That created, and I didn't realize that it rewires your brain. It does all these other things. But when I started understanding what it was, what complex PTSD was, and then I looked at my life, it was like all of those pieces of why did I behave that way? Why did I have this constant problem?
Exactly.
What was this? It was like what I, you know, all those things finally fit. They made sense.
Yeah.
They seemed to fit the profile, and so now I finally had a way. At least I had an understanding of why I was wounded, and I used to say I was a flawed individual, and I was told that I really shouldn't see myself that way. That I had been wounded, and that I could heal from those wounds. And rather than seeing myself as completely as a broken soul, I saw myself, I could see myself as somebody who had wounds that I could address how to heal them.
Yeah.
And that became another transformational phase for me.
Yeah.
And it was important because it was at that time I started reevaluating my career. I started reevaluating my life goals, my priorities, my relationship with my children and my family. I started realizing how my PTSD has hurt them, and whether I was actually pursuing, you know, I started realizing that the high stress situations I was putting myself in constantly wasn't helping.
Amazing what awareness gives us. You were made aware of things, and it affected like your whole life. Cause all it's like you walked into a dark room and someone turned the light on and you went, oh my goodness. Wow. That's what awareness does.
and it's hard to really look at yourself and realize that how badly you've behaved and how many people you've hurt, and then also understand that I can't take the blame for how it happened, mm-hmm. but I couldn't not take responsibility to do something now that I knew.
Right. Yeah, you did the work and you're still doing the work.
And I still am. And you're still
doing the work. And you're doing an amazing thing with books also. Was that part of your healing journey too? Because now you write these thrillers. You have three of them. And I don't want to run out of time and we can't talk about your books. So I want to make sure we bring them up now. Is that part of your journey of writing those?
It is. It's therapeutic for me. It's a real, I love books because I'm not really good with being lazy. I have to be busy all the time. It's still an impulse, but between research and writing and editing, and I do a lot of research. So my, my books can incorporate some, all the things I've learned in my experiences in my career about climate change and politics and technology, artificial intelligence. I've done contracts, I did contracts with the government around cybersecurity. And so I can bring all of those really fascinating things that I've learned. And I really have some had some fascinating experiences that most people don't even have an awareness of. But it allowed me to create characters that were different than your typical Tom Clancy, James Rawlings, Steve Barry kind of character, where they're really upstanding people and they work for the government and they're very patriotic and they can kill you seven ways before breakfast, sir. and to create characters that were traumatized, that had been flawed, that had been, that they all had some sort of, one might be autistic, one might have had a parent die, one might have grown up in the foster care system and just had real issues with authority. But make them as intelligent people, witty people with a sense of humor, self-aware to a great extent. I could work through a lot of my issues through characters without diving directly into my own personal experience, which might trigger me in terms of revealing or talking about.
Do you think people reading your book, it would help them to do that same thing? Like you said, helps you process some of your trauma without going too deep. Do you think it helps people do that other than, not other than, as if I'm making less than, it's entertaining, you write fiction, so it's for entertainment, but would it also help people who are struggling with something maybe?
I find that when I talk to my readers, they relate to the characters. They love the characters because they're not, cliche.
Plastic and perfect.
Plastic and perfect. They're not cliche. And they can relate to the fact that they're struggling doing the right thing because of what they've been through, but they still somehow find the courage to do the right thing. Yeah. And so that's really been, I find that readers do get a lot out of that. I think if nothing else, I find it helpful for me to create characters I can identify with more. My books have won a number of awards. I've been compared to Don Brown a lot, Robert Ludlum. And so it's helping me to really feel that's my third act career. And I deal with risks around artificial intelligence and kind of where we're going and prophecy and time prophecy. And these are all things that have a very grounded. I do a lot of research into the real roots of it. One quick example is my last book, The Last Ark, is based on the Ark of the Covenant that left Israel 2,600 years ago, was in on Elephant Island in Egypt for 900 years before it was moved to Ethiopia, where it was in synagogue for several hundred years. And then the Templars moved them into churches where they've been ever since. In January 21, 750 men, women, and children were massacred when that ark was stolen and sold on the black market.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm always driving for real truths, real issues, and then basically building on top of that speculative scenarios as to what's going on behind all that.
Wow, that's fascinating. What are the names of your three books?
The first one is The Curse of Cortez, which is the first historical thriller I've had. And that actually connects a true billion-dollar, 30-ton lost plunder with that also had three ships and 500 souls gone missing. And I was able to tie that. That was Henry Morgan's abandoned plunder. He abandoned it because he survived, was knighted, but he went into this haunted, drunken debauchery and burned his logbooks to keep the world from learning the truth of really what happened and why he would abandon $1 billion worth of plunder. But I tied that to a discovery by F.A. Mitchell Hedges in 1911. It tied back to an Inquisition massacre, tied back to a 2,000-year pilgrimage to an island. That pilgrimage tied to the 5,000-year Mayan calendar, and that 5,000-year calendar tied directly to the Mayan creation myth. And so it was a really amazing journey for me to really explore. The other two books are both based on a true experience I had where I accidentally discovered a small Associated Press article about how a program had escaped the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories at Sandia, which is a well-known NSA spy lab. So when I figured out, and I'd spent months trying to figure out how a program could escape the NSA spy labs, and what did they design it to do that it had that amazing stealth capability, two FBI agents showed up at my door. Now, that freaked my new wife out quite a bit. We'd only been married a couple of years at the time. And so she's trying to figure out, okay, why are there two FBI agents sitting in my dining room? What did you do?
What did you do?
Who are you really? And so that conversation went on for several weeks, actually.
And that's your second book? What's the name of that one?
Those are the other two books are based on the artificial intelligence and that program that had escaped, which I now turned into a character, and all of the things, political and espionage things behind the scenes that kind of involve all that. But that was based on a true story, and then I do a lot of true research on top of that. So they're great books. They're really entertaining. They're really enlightening. I retired from my career in part to lower my stress levels because I started realizing that I had reached a stage where making more money was less important than me than finally finding that place of mental health.
Oh yeah.
And I wanted to rearrange my priorities, rearrange my lifestyle. I moved out to outside the city to a small place in the Puget Sound, which overlooked the water. So I can just trying to focus on reclaiming that sense of mental wellness and peace and serenity and perspective. And my books deal with prophecy, so it hopefully educates without all of the dogma and bias. So hopefully it provides people with a perspective of kind of where we're going and how to find peace in that and how to listen to what the scriptures would tell us about who we become inside, and that's how we prepare. That has nothing to do with bunkers or politics or anything else, personal choices we make.
So where can people connect with you and get copies of your book?
Well, I'm on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and about 8 other places that are distributed. The easiest place to go is guymorrisbooks.com. It has buy links, it has review links and highlights, has image libraries of the real locations, it has fact versus fiction pages, so you can see the research that I've done to basically sort out, you know, to kind of lay that real foundation of factual foundation, and some videos. So it's a great place to start, and you'll have all three books there.
That's awesome. And before we tie this up, is there something that you want everyone to know, something you want to leave them with, what you've been through and how far you've come, or something you want to say to encourage them? Just
Absolutely.
Anything you'd like to add?
You know, I'm a good example that you can be hurt to the point where you would rather die. And I spent years in a semi-suicidal state, particularly as a child. I actually started thinking of killing myself at 7 years old. And no one can discount how badly you've been hurt. No one can discount how hard it is to heal, but I'm a good example that it's possible. And you just have to be humble. You have to be courageous. You have to do the work of facing those things and understanding and finding that sense of self insight and self-awareness. But coming out of that fog is well worth, I would never change the, it was as painful as it was at times, I would never give up the things I did to heal, because I've now can see the purpose for why I had to go through those things to become the man I am. And I would encourage anyone who's healing to seek help, to find someone you can trust, but don't give up. Just don't give up. Even you might give up even for a short period of time, get up again and do it again, because it will be worthwhile in the long run. And I'm a great example. I went from a homeless, hopeless, angry, bitter, traumatized street kid. And now I've lived a productive, fulfilling, joyful, complete life. And even though it was a struggle for many of those years, and I'm still working on it, it just means that I have hope for tomorrow to keep working. And I'm just a radically different person than I was 40 years ago. And it's well worth every ounce of effort I put into it.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that, Guy. And I echo that with him. Our listeners, thank you for being with us today. And I echo that there is hope. As long as you're breathing, there's hope. Don't give up. Thank you, Guy, for opening your heart. Thank you for sharing things I know that were hard. I hope that I didn't push you too hard on anything today. Thank you for all your contributions that you've given to society in the face of all the things that the world tried to steal from you. So thank you. And I'm sorry for the pain that you have gone through.
Thank you.
And our listeners, remember, you matter. I love you. And go get one of Guy's books. So until next time, I love you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Victorious Souls Podcast. You matter and you are loved. We'd love to connect with you further, so please visit us at danielleburnock.com and grab a copy of Danielle's free audiobook. And remember, only you can change your life. No one can do it for you.